depth is everything in that market. And with Eric Swanson coming off of a really remarkable year, you know, getting both sides of the plate out on a regular basis, a very high strikeout rate with a well above average weapon in his split. We feel his fastball plays above average with a slightly above average slider that attacked right-handed hitters and left-handed hitters exceptionally well.
Fan Drive Time, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, Ben Ennis, Blake Murphy. That, of course, was Ross Atkins. You know who else is above average? Teoscar Hernandez, man. That guy's one of the best corner outfielders in Major League Baseball, has been over the last 2 years. I understand the move the Blue Jays pulled off today cannot be viewed in a vacuum because there is somebody incoming, whether that's via free agency or trade. But Blue Jays are worse today than they were yesterday. Just a matter of fact. Let's talk to our pal Adnan Virk of MLB Network. Yeah, it's a big, big splashy trade to start the offseason, kind of unofficially, Adnan.
Yeah, Ben, I've been poo-pooing this all along, saying nothing's going to happen, no one's getting signed, there's no movement, right? We were saying in the past it was really exciting leading into the winter meetings, and all of a sudden, bam, we got a couple moves here. So I was surprised as anybody was, but you're right, for you and those who are really avid observers of what happens at Toronto, this should not be that surprising because for a variety of reasons. One, as you mentioned, there could be something happening, whether that's signing Brandon Nimmo or other moves happening. But two, Teoscar is a guy who is going to get paid. I mean, he's entering the final year of arbitration eligibility. He's a free agent after next season. He's 30 years of age. So you have to pay up and give him, you know, a five-year, $100 million contract. The Jays don't want to do that or don't believe they could do that because they still got to lock up Vlad Jr., still got to lock up Bobichet, et cetera. You flip him right now and you get something for him. But there's no doubt, as you said, they're worse off without him. This guy was an all-star. I mean, his numbers, when I looked at him again, I go, wow, 870 OPS, 32 home runs, 524 slug. That power plays everywhere, even in Seattle, which is why he's so critical, because that place is so pitcher-friendly. And Swanson, you hope he's going to be good. Obviously, the bullpen was a weakness for Toronto. He had a 1.68 ERA. Love his ERA plus, 222. League average is 170 Ks and 53 and two-thirds. They needed bullpen help, and he is an upgrade. But obviously, it's nowhere near close enough, even with Macko, who was a guy in high A. Who knows what he's going to do? The Jays are worse off without them, but they improved their bullpen, and they wish Teoscar well. This guy, though, Ben, as you said, we're going to talk about him a lot tonight on MLB Network at 8 o'clock Eastern. He's one of the most underrated sluggers in the game. He really is. And his numbers bear that out, and I think he'll do well in Seattle.
Adnan, I'm supposed to be the advanced numbers guy here. You're eating off my plate here, man. Come on. the other element of Teoscar, and I agree with everything you said about him as a hitter I mentioned earlier, he's 11th all-time in Blue Jays home runs after just five seasons. Wow. He is really, really good, like 30 to 40% above league average at the plate. And he's still in his prime. The other element with the Teoscar trade, and I'm sure this is going to come up on MLB Network too, I don't know that there's a more popular player around baseball with other players. Everyone seems to think Teoscar is their best friend. Vlad posted a very sad goodbye to him on Instagram. We've heard guys like Jose Ramirez talk about their relationships with Teoscar. How do you weigh that in when you're looking at something like this? It's obviously not the most important thing, but it does feel like a big part of Teoscar Hernandez's legacy in Toronto and perhaps in Seattle, where I believe he has a relationship with Luis Castillo already, is that, you know, he makes things enjoyable for the guys around him, and over 162 game grind, that can be pretty important.
Yeah, I mean, listen, if you and I like analytics, that means we generally shouldn't care about things like team chemistry. But, of course, it does matter. You know, you can't quantify these things. But, yes, it does matter when guys do get along. And Seattle has a good clubhouse. The big reason why is because of Julio Rodriguez. And that guy is the rookie of the year. He's got all five tools. And his sixth tool is his charisma. I mean, everyone loves Julio Rodriguez. He lights up the room with that smile. So you add Teoscar in there, who's a jolly giant, all of a sudden you go, wow, that's a really fun clubhouse. And guys will all get along well there. And listen, DePoto, more than anything, forget about his chemistry and the way that Teoscar is a guy. He was looking to fill in some power. They needed the upgrade. Even after a 90-win season, they needed power in Seattle. And Teoscar Hernandez is going to bring that. He has hit at least 20 homers in every year since 2018, other than the COVID short in 2020. And again, 129 WRC plus, league average is 100. 2.4 wins above replacement, according to Fangraphs. Like, he is going to be, as you said, a 30% above average. And for DePoto, it's smart because he opts not to extend Mitch Haniger that $19.65 million qualifying offer. And the rumors had been Brandon Nimmo potentially going to Seattle, which I didn't like at all for this reason. Nimmo's only played over 100 games twice in his career. Now, he can hit. He hits like 274, good on-base guy, but not much slug. He hit like 16 home runs. And I'm like, Seattle, you need some home runs. I can't imagine a lineup. Kyle Lewis, the former Rookie of the Year, he can't stay healthy. Haniger, they just declined the option. J-Rod's outstanding. And then you add Nimmo. I'm like, that just feels like an odd fit. So Nimmo is a guy who I think is going to be courted because of the fact by on-base percentage, the last few years, he's like top 10, especially among outfielders. I believe he's top 5. So he gets on base. But I don't like him in Seattle because he does not bring enough power to the lineup. So, again, Teoscar, as you said, good guy, well-liked, and he really fills in what Seattle needs, which is the fact they're deficient in power, and he gives them that. They were 17th last year in slugging percentage. They were 10th in home runs. A lot of those hit by Eugenio Suarez, Cal Raleigh, and Julio Rodriguez. Aside from those three guys, they were very boomer bust. And now they got four guys who can hit home runs.
I do remember the Scott Boras on Brandon Nimmo. It was whoever picks our guy is going to be
there. It is
finding Nimmo.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that was the Scott Boras sell on Brandon Nimmo. I like him. He costs a lot. He's 30 years old. You know, here's an element to this trade that we haven't discussed yet. And there's not a lot of elements because we're already an hour into this show and we've done a lot on it and we're going to continue to do lots on it. But okay, so this is a Mariners team that just dumped the Blue Jays out of the playoffs, summarily dismissed them in two games. The second game go down as an all-timer in people's minds. And I understand they don't play in the same division. But you know what? Division rivalries don't matter as much in 2023. We have a more balanced schedule. Those two teams are going to be, all right, trying to win their divisions. They didn't this year. Are maybe battling for the same playoff spot. What do you think about two American League playoff teams trading with each other, the Blue Jays giving up a silver slugger to the team that just knocked them out of the playoffs?
It is notable, Ben. Like, it's not quite the Yankees and Red Sox making a trade or the Dodgers and the Giants, but it is notable. Like, this really shouldn't be happening. As you said, you're competing in the same league and oftentimes fighting for the same wild card spots because right now the division is going to be tough to win. It doesn't mean Seattle can't win the division or Toronto can't, but if I was a bet man right now, I'd say I don't think the Mariners and Blue Jays win their divisions next year. So you're right. They're two of the, you know, four or five teams that are theoretically battling for that wild card spot. So it certainly does raise an eyebrow, but maybe it's helpful in this respect. You know, in the past, people were so skittish about this and maybe got caught up too much in their allegiances and you can only trade with this team or that team. Now they go, you know what? Who knows? Maybe next year Seattle is going to be a boomer bust team and Julio Rodriguez will get hurt and Luis Castillo will all of a sudden come back down to earth and they're not even going to contend. And maybe for DePoto, he says, well, look at the Blue Jays. Maybe all of a sudden they implode. Maybe a sudden Gossman gets hurt and Manoah has an offseason, so I don't have to worry about competing with these guys. I need talent. I'll take that talent. So I think you're right that you could certainly look at it, and it feels a little awkward to say the least. These are two teams that came into the league at the same time who battled in a wild card series, now helping each other. But it is a nice thought to always think, too, hey, there are trades that can help each other. And Dan O'Dowd, who I work with here, you know, does a great job, obviously here on MLB Network, longtime Rockies GM. He said there were certain GMs that were so frustrating to deal with because they always had to win the trade. And he would tell them, listen, you're getting a good player. I'm getting a good player. This is going to help both of our teams. But certain GMs are so intent on winning and trying to screw you. And that's not the way to do business. So at the very least, I guess we can appreciate Toronto and Seattle realizing the cost of good business and trying to help each other.
I'm of the mind, too, that, you know, at least until you're at the very tippy top, like if you're the Astros and you want to think like that, sure. Right now, you got to just worry about making your team the best it could possibly be, and everything else will flow from there. And if you run into Seattle in the playoffs, well, hey, at least you got to the playoffs and you're facing that problem there. And there are teams in the American League who stand kind of ahead above the Blue Jays and the Mariners right now. You mentioned a couple of them there, Adnan. The Yankees bringing back Anthony Rizzo, what do you make of where they are and the fact that we haven't really heard a whole lot about the Aaron Judge stuff just yet?
Well, I don't think Judge signs anytime soon. I was just banding it about here with a few of the guys at work. I said, you know, as we've said before, normally in the past, free agency, things would happen, especially at the winter meetings. Now, I don't think Carlos Correa signs until like February 10th. Like, you know that guy's going to wait it out as long as he can. I don't think Trey Turner signs until 2023. I don't think Jacob DeGrom signs until 2023. Like, I think those guys are going to wait and say, hey, I work out year-round. I don't have to rush to get a deal done. Now, the one guy who I think will take his time, or perhaps the Yankees bowl him away, is Aaron Judge. If Aaron Judge signs December 10th because the Yankees, you know, we're giving you 9 years and $350 million, then I think he takes the deal. Like, I think ultimately it's 50-50 whether it's the Yankees or other teams. And the other teams are Dodgers and their Giants and it's Cardinals – maybe Cubs. Like, those are the teams in the mix, theoretically speaking. But I do think deep in his heart, Blake, Aaron Judge would prefer to stay a Yankee. He just wants to get paid, just wants to get taken care of. He wants to be the highest-paid Yankee. Jim Bowden, my former colleague at ESPN, now writes to the Athletic, former GM, 8 years, 330 gets it done. And he's right, because 330 means he's the highest-paid player of the Yankee. He beats Gerrit Cole's 324, and he makes over $100 million more than he would have got a season ago. Now, what does this matter with Rizzo? Him and Rizzo are tight. How tight? Well, there was some thought they could be a package deal and go to San Francisco or Los Angeles. So I think it's a really good move by the Yankees, first and foremost. Rizzo had a lot of power last year. You know, he was not a coveted guy a season ago. Yankees signed him to a two-year deal, the opt-out. After one, he opts out and takes care of business. He goes from a two-year $32 million deal to two-year $40 million deal. So good for Anthony Rizzo. He gets $8 million more. As I mentioned, the power certainly played, the short porch there. Still doesn't hit for average. I kind of get annoyed when I see Rizzo's numbers. This guy only hits like 225 now. But good on-base guy, knows how to work a walk, loves getting hit by a pitch, and he's got that slugging percentage. And again, back to the good guy argument, people love Anthony Rizzo. You never hear a bad word about the guy, beloved in the clubhouse, feels like a true Yankee. You know, in many ways, Rizzo feels more like a Yankee than Giancarlo Stanton. 100%. Even though Stanton's been there longer, right? Rizzo, in 1 year, you go, that guy just feels like a New York Yankee. He feels like a Paul O'Neill type, right? Everyone there loves the guy, fits well with the city, with the ethos. So I think it's a really good move for the Yankees, and can only mean good things for signing Aaron Judge, because Judge and Rizzo certainly are tight.
Yeah, and we'll see how Rizzo benefits from the lack of shift next year. Might be one of those rare guys that actually sees a real bump in batting average specifically. I guess the only comparable to Bryce Harper is Bobby Bonn, who played with a broken leg. Bryce Harper was the best offensive player in the postseason with, I guess, a messed up UCL. Like, the guy might have Tommy John surgery. How should we look back at that postseason run now, considering this guy might not even play baseball in 2023?
Love a good Bobby Bonn reference. People will remember that forever in Toronto sports history. It is amazing. I remember, like, as a kid reading, like, you know, Brian McFarlane reading, like, hockey tales. Like, what? How could this guy win a Stanley Cup with a broken leg? It's crazy to even fathom. And yet you're right. What Harper did is remarkable. You know, if it is indeed Tommy John, I don't think that's confirmed, right? It's just UCL tear. Yeah. But if it's Tommy John, he's probably not going to be back. I mean, I remember Didi Gregorius had Tommy John on the Yankees. He wasn't back until June. So, theoretically, if it's Tommy John, Bryce Harper could miss 3 months of the season. Now, this is where the universal DH was such a godsend for Harper and the Phillies. He didn't play the field, fellas, I don't believe, from mid-April on. Yep. Like, he was just DHing. So, like, and that completely changes the complexion of this Phillies season. He literally could not have played the field. If he could have, he would have. They would not have had Bryce Harper. He would have had the surgery earlier, and that's it. They do not make the World Series, period. Instead, he's able to withstand the pain, fight through it, has a postseason for the ages. That home run in Game 5 off Suarez will be one of the great Phillies moments ever, and it's the signature moment of this past postseason, and now he gets the surgery done. I'm with you, Ben. I already love the guy, and I think you can even glorify him even more, because he certainly is a football player in a baseball player's body, right? He's got that ethics about him in which he's hard-nosed and he's tough and he's gritty, and it certainly fits the city of Philadelphia. It's why they love him so much as well. So I hope he does not miss much time, maybe because he's an outfielder rather than an infielder. He's back in, like, May, but I'd be stunned if he's back for opening day, and I think he DHs for a while until he feels comfortable enough that he can play the field.
Adnan, you mentioned football in with a big Philadelphia athlete there. I hate to do this to you, but I got to turn it to the Eagles. They lose the undefeated season with a 26-7 or 32-21 loss to the Washington Commanders, rather. I thought it would have been funniest if they lost this coming week against Jeff Saturday's Indianapolis Colts, who may have just got McDaniels let go. We'll see how that one plays out. The Eagles, though, at 8-1, obviously there are a lot of ways you can spin an 8-1 positively. How about this one? The pressure of being undefeated would have continued to mount as the season went on. This loss allows the Eagles to take the long view now.
I mean, I'll take whatever you're selling, Blake, but there's no doubt I was incredibly frustrated, because it's the TV guy within me. I'm like, hey, don't lose on Monday Night Football. We got Buck, we got Aikman, we got the city of Philadelphia, we got Pats and Geno's, we got fancy cartoons here about, you know, cheese sticks. We have a fascinating conversation. Great job by Robert Griffin III. Mm-hmm. You got Donovan McNabb. And all we were missing, I mean, clearly, listen, it was great seeing McNabb and Michael Vick and Jalen Hurts together, but we needed Cunningham. Like, Cunningham's the reason I became an Eagles fan. My man Rodney Pete, like a very frank, interesting conversation about being a black quarterback in Philly, and then they go out there and they lay that kind of an egg? Like, just a sloppy performance. And credit to Washington. That is truly a great game plan. Hey, don't give them the ball. Just run with the bandit. We're going to have time of possession over 40 minutes, and we're going to win this game. And with Taylor Heinicke, they were able to do so. And those turnovers to Philly killed us. Yeah, Goddard particularly. I mean, they don't call the face mask. Not the ref's fault, by the way. Eagles did not deserve to win that game. But they don't call the face mask. That fumble. Now, he's out 4 weeks. He's second on the team in receiving yards and tied for second in receiving touchdowns. Dallas Goedert has been the new Zach Ertz for this Eagles team. So that's a pretty big loss, and we have to hope the other tight ends can step in. A.J. Brown was completely silenced. Again, Washington secondary did a great job. I expect him to lose at some point, Blake. I'm not delusional, but not against the Commanders on Monday Night Football, because now you're tied with the Vikings. Like, one loss changes everything. Now you're 8-1, and that number one seed is so critical for the bye. Like, you've got to create breathing room, because you might lose that game at Dallas. Like, that's not inconceivable. You might lose against the Packers on Sunday Night Football. So it's just frustrating to lose that kind of a game, because now, as I mentioned, you're tied for the top spot with Minnesota, no breathing room, and you're only one game up on the Giants and only two games up on Dallas, and that's a game you should have won. Frustration all around.
Was there anything in that game, and Washington had a, like you said, a great game plan. I'm not sure every team can replicate that with the offensive line and running back play and kind of handle the clock that way. Was there anything in that Eagles loss that gives you pause over, you know, when you look ahead to the playoffs? Like, is there something that you took from that that is like, man, they really got to work on that, or that's something a lot of teams could exploit, not just a team that has two volume running backs like Washington?
Well, I think what happened was that we were focusing on the secondary and the fact that Heinicke was able to make some plays, but it was also the fact that they weren't able to generate nearly enough pressure up front. And the strength of that Eagles team is their defensive line. Like, they can rotate seven or eight guys through there. And the fact that Hargrave and Barnett and Fletcher Cox were all pretty quiet was surprising to me. So I don't think that's something other teams can replicate. I just think, you know, sometimes guys have an off night, and clearly that was the issue for Philly. They just weren't nearly good enough. But their fatal flaw is the fact that they do give up way too many rushing yards. I mean, that's 160 rushing yards per game allowed in the last two games. They're very good at generating pressure on the quarterback, but they got to do a better job of stopping the run. Offensively, though, I have no issues. I love how they run the ball. Miles Sanders is great. Hurts is obviously having a phenomenal season. We've mentioned the receivers before, Brown and Devontae Smith. Even without Goddard, they have guys who can step up. Kelce, the anchor of that offensive line. They're going to score points. They just shot themselves in the foot with those bad turnovers. But defensively, got to improve that run defense. You mentioned the Colts and Jeff Saturday. I know he's taking a beating, but I love Jeff Saturday. I worked with him a few times at ESPN. Boy, he's got some dreamy eyes. You look at those baby blue eyes, and you'll believe anything he tells you. And he's a great guy. I mean, he really is. So I know everyone's killing him. He's never coached since high school, but I worked with him half a dozen times, always liked him a lot. I hope Jeff Saturday is the coach of the year. He's a really good dude.
No, they killed him last week. This is the redemption week for Jeff Saturday. Now it's everybody killing the Bill Cowers of the world, right? Like, now it's him, his turn to go through the meat grinder.
Yeah,
for sure. Adnan, great chat as always. We'll talk next week, man.
Ben and Blake, I appreciate it. By the way, the fact that the World Cup is coming up, are you kidding me? Like, just after the greatest sports month we can all enjoy, now we got to dig into the World Cup, and we actually can care as Canadians. We're actually in this thing. It's crazy to me.
I love it. Yeah, we'll talk about that maybe next week. See you, man.
Be well, boys. Thank you.
There's Adnan Virk, MLB Network. This is something that I was sharing with you and producer Mike Gentile earlier today, like talking about the running game, and you watch that game, the Commanders controlled – like the entire clock. I think the first half they had like a 23-minute to 7-minute advantage in time of possession because they're just running the ball. Guess what? Everybody's running the ball in the NFL this year. Dan Orlovsky had a great rundown in like a big 10-minute segment that was going around Twitter today about how yards per attempt on the ground are the highest ever in the history of the NFL. Completed passes, the amount of yards gained per average completed pass are like the lowest since 1930, so essentially the lowest in the history of the sport. Scoring is down, but that, like, it wasn't that long ago we were talking about. Remember that Chiefs-Rams shootout game where it was like 100 points, and that's the future of football. And there seems to be like a resetting in the sport now, Blake, that, yeah, the running game and defense is kind of in vogue. It still does help to have Patrick Mahomes. But yeah, like the idea that you can score 60 points a game seemingly going out the window.
It does. Now, there are good things to this and bad things. And yeah. I think the good thing is, like we just talked about with Adnan, you get teams who are, you know, you can get a little bit of rock, paper, scissors going on where the Eagles were 8-0.
Yeah.
And the Commanders just happened to be the team well suited with their strengths to take advantage of the few Eagles weaknesses. Now, we're going to see also, can the Eagles clean that up? Because we talk about Jeff Saturday. Washington rushed the ball a lot in that game and controlled the clock. Guess what Jeff Saturday wants to do and wants to do with that Colts team with Jonathan Taylor and Deion Jackson, if he's healthy as well. They want to run the ball a lot. Jonathan Taylor had 22 carries in Jeff Saturday's first game. Part of that was he was going off for seven a tote, but they're going to try to run the ball. And we'll see if the Eagles can bounce back. So I like that it creates these kind of contrasts in strength and weaknesses. I don't think lower scoring is good for the sport.
No.
But I do think getting away from every team playing the same, which is something we've talked about in a lot of sports over the last couple of years, this kind of homogenous play style in each sport where everyone's trying to play the same way because this is the trend or this is what wins. A lot of teams tried to replicate what the Warriors were doing.
Yeah.
It's like, well, no more centers because Draymond's a center. It's like, okay, well, there's only one Draymond. And then it's like, well, look at the Chiefs. Everyone should play lightning fast. It's like, okay, well, there's only one Patrick Mahomes and one Tyreek Hill. Not every team could play that way. So I do like that football over time, naturally the equilibrium shifts where, hey, passing is so en vogue and stretching the field vertically is so important that every defense then becomes more adept and more eager to drop two safeties back and play a more stretched out vertical defense. And then the counter move is offenses being like, well, there are fewer guys in the box.
Right.
And if you can break through that first line,
yeah,
look at how much room there is for, you know, those 5 to 15 yard carries before a safety can crack back in. And then if this continues and we see a team with a heavy rushing attack win the Super Bowl this year, or, you know, three of the final four teams are rush heavy teams and the stats continue to tilt that way, we'll see it come back the other way. And that's kind of what football is. And I think with a sport like football, where there are two very distinct ways to score and create offense, that stylistic diversity and that kind of push and pull league-wide is good for the sport. I think it's what makes football such a fascinating strategic sport.
I agree with you just about everything you said. Because the I guess there could be...
Don't agree with me.
No, no, no. Well, but here's the thing. Right. If it is copycat and everybody does what you're saying and, you know, all these games are 20-17 and we lose the appeal of the Patrick Mahomes, Josh Allen's of the world, and that goes out the window, that is bad. But I don't think that's going to happen. Right. Like it's not the case that passing is ever going to be, you know, something that you don't want to have in your back pocket.
No,
and it's about, yeah, adjustments.
2020 was an outlier scoring season. Like, scoring is down. So the 21.9 points per game right now that teams are averaging is the second lowest that we've had since 2009. So safe to say that it is a really down scoring year. But also, scoring usually is within a 2-point band. Like, it doesn't vary that much season to season. And what we've seen over the last decade plus is if there's a small bump in offense, then next year there's a small decline. The only real outlier was that 2020 season where, whether it was a change in the how aggressively you practiced or, you know, just rushing into the season, any whatever factors you want in 2020, you know, that was a year where teams averaged like 25 points, and that's just a complete outlier. So I don't think it's completely out of the ordinary for this to be, well, scoring's down a point or two for each team a game. I think it'll probably bounce right back up.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. Defense is fun, too. Like, that's the other thing. It's like, we don't have to be Dumbo sports fans who's like, oh, the points are good. Like, you can actually,
you know, you could be a Dumbo sports fan and be like, oh, big tackles are good.
Well, okay, how about both? How about all of it? How about enjoying the entire sport? How about enjoying, you know, the not every 1-0 hockey game is good, but the idea that there is a 1-0 hockey game that can be entertaining is true.
We're going to see it tomorrow. We're going to talk about it heading into that Leafs-Devils game where the Devils are, you know, tactically unique and strategically unique with how they approach defense in hockey. And I don't think it's like the Scott Stevens, Marty Brodeur trap era of the Devils. I think there's something fascinating to how they're doing that. We'll dive into that more tomorrow. But again, it's something where not every team playing the same is great. It makes it more entertaining, makes every matchup over the course of a short season of football or a long season in hockey or basketball more interesting.
Yeah. Do I want like hand checking to come back to the NBA? Probably not. Like, would it be nice if there was like one Bad Boys Pistons team that's like their calling card? Yeah, that's cool. Right.
The closest thing would have been tonight, but with no Bam and no Tyler Hero, not that Tyler Hero is the Bad Boys Pistons style guy, but he kind of helps a lot of things go with that offense. But the Heat over the last couple of years have been the closest thing to that.
Heat Raptors tonight on Sportsnet 1. When we come back, we're getting close to what used to be known as Lou Marsh season. Not called the Lou Marsh Trophy anymore, the Northern Star Award. We'll talk to the executive director of the Northern Star Award, Damian Cox, next. As the Fan Drive Time continues, Ben Ennis, Blake Murphy, Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Dive deep into Toronto sports and the NFL, the J.D. Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Fan Drive Time, Sportsnet 590, The Fan, Ben Ennis and Blake Murphy. And on December 7th, we will find out the first ever winner of the Northern Star Award. Now, you may remember this award formerly as the Lou Marsh Trophy. Damian Cox is our Leafs historian. He's also the executive director of now the Northern Star Award, and he joins us now. Hey, Damian.
I have all these jobs that pay me no money now.
That's right.
You know, yeah. I have all these. So you two guys, yes. I want to know, what do you think? Does it grab you at all, the name? Does it work for you? Are you like, I don't think so. Do you think it might grow over time? Give me your impression.
Well, yeah. It took me a second, right? Because and Blake is as newer to this industry, but like, this is Lou Marsh season, right? And that, like, some synapses fire in your brain when you hear Lou Marsh and you know what that is. And I will say that at first blush, I was like, huh? And then I read the piece that you wrote today and the woman who suggested the name, and there's a lot of sense to be made with it. I think it's one of those things that's going to have to grow on me a little bit because, you know, the Lou Marsh Award became ubiquitous with Canada's Athlete of the Year.
Yeah. Blake, what do you think?
Yeah, I feel about the same. I thought that and you guys had a great conversation about this around this time last year when maybe a little later than this, but when it first started coming up that, hey, this name should be changed. I thought you guys had a really good and nuanced conversation about the arguments for and against. And I think, it was time to move off of that name. You probably wanted to go something that wasn't person specific, just in case moving forward. And it's something that, look, any award name seems a little new when it's new. And then a year or two from now, everyone will be like, the Northern Star Award.
Yeah. Well, and that's what I'm really liking this, the way this whole thing is going right now. Cause I'm clearly running the conversation, not Ben. So this is, this is working out well for me. Thank you so much. I used to do a bit of that stuff you did.
Yeah.
Anyway. That's a great point, Blake, about a person's name. And let me tell you, like, we went through so many names, and there were a lot of very worthy people. And I guess, you know, do many of us now have a bit of stage fright about that, or apprehension that if we honor an individual, it's going to come back and bite us, that something's going to be said or something was said, a lot, you know, 40 years ago. And is this the era where we're in now, guys, where we can't honor anybody by naming a school or a street or a trophy or anything after them because of the world in which we live in which everything and nothing ever goes away and stuff comes back?
I don't think that's the case. I think, you know, we live in an era where certainly people are looking for that stuff. And I do think most people are looking for that stuff, earn it like out of an earnest intent and not just to create situations. It's also a case where, you know, yeah, you don't want to name things after really, really old figures from history, because the history here in Canada, the U.S. is very colonial and very not good in a lot of cases. I do think, though, you're in an era where, say, you guys had all sat down and were debating a person to name it after. Well, we're also in an era where all of this information is pretty readily available about people. Sure, people who are still alive and still, you know, around, maybe there's, you can find out things after the case. You can't really assume anyone is a good person, you know, all the time anymore. But I certainly think, you know, if you were going back to the Lou Marsh era, you're going to someone from the 50s or 60s, we can at least at this point, you know, the other side of the sword of, well, anyone could get information dug up about them to say they shouldn't have it is, well, we can do that information searching ourselves. We can do our own due diligence. Right. And if we are going to honor people, make sure that we're honoring people who were good citizens on top of being good athletes or good figures in the sports community.
Yeah, I mean, and like, I don't know who your guys' personal heroes are. I mean, you know, in the case of this, I think one of the issues was, after having this trophy named after a white male for so long, would it have been right to give, for example, another white male the honor? And there, it kind of goes around and around. And that's why, you know, we end up saying, let's not name it after a person. And I think that's probably, at the end of the day, the right idea.
It was well done by you, Damien, to use your hosting skills to ask us the question so that we don't ask you the question. Like, if you thought that I was going to forget that we had you on to discuss this whole thing, like, no, you're wrong. What do you think, as the executive director of the Northern Star Award? What do you think? Is a name just a name, and it's the spirit of the thing that counts the most anyways? Like, how do you feel about it?
Well, I mean, I think the whole thing is complicated, and we had a long chat about this last year, and you know, I still think it's an interesting discussion to, you know, whether it's fair for us 100 years after or whatever since Lou Marsh was around to go back and judge him based on our standards today. I think that's an interesting discussion that goes on in a lot of walks of life now. But the decision was made, and to go down, you know, and we were going to do something else. Do I like the name? Yes, I like it. I don't love it, but I hope I'm going to grow to love it. And I'm hoping it's going to be kind of like, it feels awkward right now. Just exactly what you say. And, you know, I knew that this was going to happen in the next little while. That this name was going to come out. And I was getting texts and emails last week about performance by Félix Auger-Aliassime or other people saying, well, that's got to be Lou Marsh worthy. You know, it's been a part of our language for a long period of time. So I can tell you this, I didn't have a better idea. I really didn't. You know, I think there wasn't an idea or a person or, you know, a concept that I really, really was like, this is what it's got to be. And so when this came around, this kind of worked, you know, and it was funny. It was just, you know, people were talking about North Star, but Northern Star for some reason rang a little bit better. There were, our new governor general has on her coat of arms an Inuit word that's a very powerful word. Would that have been, given what we're talking about here, Lou Marsh, Tom Longboat, all that stuff, would that have been a correct direction to go? But, you know, doing some research, there is not one universal idea or word that that all Indigenous people in this country use or unite behind. So that wouldn't have made any sense either. So I kind of feel as though we're kind of neutral with Northern Star, but maybe that's what we should be. Maybe that's what we should be. And then the emphasis goes on not what the name of the trophy is, but on what athlete we're going to give it to this year. And you know, I'm going to end up coming back and asking you guys who we should give it to, but I won't do that now because Ben's getting upset with he's losing control of his show.
No, he's fine. And you know, I like that point about you looked for potential indigenous language to involve it. And even if you went that route, you know, Polaris, which is the Inuit word for the North Star, is already used for a music prize in Canada every year. So, I think you guys landed in a pretty good spot. The only other idea I had was, and this came to me watching the UFC on Saturday, where in the main event, Israel Adesanya against Alex Pereira, the winner not only was the champion, but was also going to be on the cover of the new video game. So I thought, hey, what if the winner of this year's award maybe doesn't have it named after them, but has a hand in determining the name? And then I got thinking about the candidates. Obviously, this is the time of year, Damian. I don't know if Ben's going to put you on the spot about potential candidates you like, but I have more of a philosophical. This award comes out December 7th. I know that the group of you will sit down in a room shortly before that and hash it out. We got a World Cup starting next Wednesday a Canadian team that hasn't been there in my lifetime. What are the chances that a really strong World Cup performance, especially if Canada can extend beyond the group stage, get someone in the conversation here, whether it's Alphonso Davies or who has won the award before, another player breakout? And I'm thinking, you know, especially if Canada gets out of the group stage, makes some noise, surprises people. Obviously, there are a number of great candidates this year, but how closely are you as a voter watching this World Cup and individual standout performances?
Very close. I mean, right now you could say, you know, Tejon Buchanan or Kyle Laren. I mean, either one of them could be a candidate this year. And there isn't one, like the year that Bianca Andreescu won, well, she was a unanimous winner. She was just head and tails above the competition. This year, I don't think we're there. You know, we've got a bunch of athletes from a bunch of different sports. So let's say Alphonso Davies or Tejon Buchanan goes out and scores two goals against Belgium. Let's just say, I mean, that's going to blow people's minds. And absolutely, I think, you know, the recency effect could take over too. And that's, people forget we had an Olympic Games back in last winter where some people did some pretty great things. And will we remember them? So I think absolutely, you know, because this is historic in so many ways to have Canada back in the World Cup, that there's every possibility that if something special were to be done by a player, that player could end up right there at the end.
Yeah, but the story might be continuing while you guys are voting. Like, Canada might still be alive. Like, they, you know, what if it's like kind of marginal and nobody really stands out in the group? Like, and I don't know if Canada will have even played its knockout match by the time you guys are voting before December 7th. What if Canada shocks the world, wins a World Cup after you guys haven't voted in Alphonso Davies? Then how's that going to look?
Then we're going to be like, you know, the player who wins the Hart Trophy in the regular season and gets knocked out in the first round, right? That's where we're going to be. And I will tell you that I think I've got my scheduling right, that December 6th is the date where Canada would, if they were to advance, where they'd be in the knockout round, that they would be playing that day. So I am aware.
Okay.
I am aware of the scheduling. Now, if it's them and Germany in the final, I guess all bets are off, right? Yeah. Then we'll figure it. Maybe we'll postpone it. Who knows?
All right. Congrats on a new era of the Northern Star Award. Damian, thanks for doing this.
Well, thanks, guys, and appreciate your input. And maybe when we figure out who it is this year, we'll have another conversation. You guys can tell me all how wrong we were.
No, you'll ask us. What do you guys think? And then you'll hope that we forget to ask you.
See you guys.
See ya. This is Damian Cox, executive director of the Northern Star Award. Yeah, it's fine. It's fine. Lou Marsh wasn't a great guy. Like, so, I mean, it's pretty easy to just not name it the Lou Marsh Award. I mean, you could have done
like Toronto Metropolitan University. Like, that's not a great name. TMU sounds like the fake college that they would go to in Friday Night Lights. Yeah. It's better still than having the school that takes up a lot of real estate in the heart of downtown Toronto named after a very bad person. So, or someone with a very bad history.
Yes. So I'm fine with it. And it's, could have easily been named the Canadian Athlete of the Year Award, which, I mean, this very building tried to create an award that rivaled the Lou Marsh Award back in the day that was called the Canadian Athlete of the Year Award. Anyways, whatever its name, that's what it is, and people know it as that, as the Canadian Athlete of the Year Award. I want to go back to the Teoscar Hernandez trade discussion and a question that you asked Shai Davidi, or a thought process that you talked to Shai Davidi about the timing of this deal. Because there's other things happening in Major League Baseball, but this is a pretty big, splashy trade in Major League Baseball. A former Silver Slugger, cornerstone piece of one of the best offenses in baseball, being traded as, I know Eric Swanson's great and all. It's like essentially a salary dump, right? Like you're clearing the decks for somebody. What does that mean? And does the timing of this move have something to do with the next move? Because I think you're right to say that now everybody knows that the Blue Jays have to add an outfielder, maybe not necessarily a corner outfielder, that agents who represent, I don't know, like a Brandon Nimmo, know that you have an opening, but has the groundwork been laid to such a degree that that's irrelevant anyways? Like, what does it all mean, Blake?
It has to mean you at least know what a plan A, B, C looks like, because if you end up holding $13 million in your hand when the season starts, and you're like, oh, we have budget space that outfielder.
Not acceptable.
Yeah, because guess what? This is business, like middle management 101 is use every penny in your budget, because if you don't, they're going to go back next year and they're going to be like, well, you obviously can operate on a leaner budget. So, I think that they probably have a couple scenarios lined up. Now, if from Atkins media availability at the end of the regular season and at the GM meetings and today, you know, you could come away with that. Like, they obviously know they have to address the outfield, but there is still this sense that they're not thrilled with where their starting pitching depth is right now, which they shouldn't be. Kikuchi and White as a 4-5, as it lines up right now, they should probably be 5-6 and maybe even 6-7.
Okay, so let me stop you there, because I agree with you.
I don't mean to turn the Teoscar conversation into a starting pitching one. I just mean if it's about payroll flexibility, it's not a lock that payroll flexibility is going to an outfielder when the starting pitching scenario isn't great yet either.
I suppose. I guess in theory, for a team that was like the second or third best offense in the American League, like taking a step back and, you know, increasing your ability to prevent runs, run prevention. Yeah, like that's a theoretical scenario. But when you talk about starting pitching and you talk about fourth, fifth, and sixth starters, which are super valuable over the course of a 162-game regular season, I think that the thinking for this organization has to change. And maybe the Phillies with their 87 wins shouldn't be a roadmap, but like almost everybody gets into the playoffs here, okay? Like the
well,
Phillies,
that's not true.
Yeah, almost everybody gets in. Everybody gets in. Oh, the Orioles didn't get in. The team that we thought was going to be, you know, one of the worst teams in all of baseball didn't get into the playoffs. Like, everybody gets in, okay? And I get it. The Red Sox are going to okay, it does not take much to get into the playoffs anymore, all right? This team, now
doesn't
that they've
take
done it.
As much.
It doesn't take very much. Okay?
All right.
I would say that the target for this team should not necessarily be guys that are, listen, I think R.A. Dickey was underrated by the fan base because he took the ball every fifth day and sometimes he got shelled, but more often than not, he gave you 5-6 respectable innings. Look at the end of the year. Like,
just
how many
took
guys,
4 hours.
Yeah, how many guys gave you 200 innings?
Nobody anymore.
No. Should that be the target that this front office goes after this offseason? I don't think so. I think you should be looking at even guys that maybe don't have the greatest injury track record, as long as you can get them healthy for the postseason. I don't know how you do that necessarily. But what I'm talking about is higher upside players as opposed to guys that you can count on all season long.
I get that. And it's why the Chris Flexen thing was so unsexy, right? It's like, yeah, this is a rotation caliber guy who was not on a playoff roster.
Right. Chris Flexen wasn't.
No. If you are looking at, well, we're a playoff team and all that matters is playoff success, if you're going with the Leafs mentality, then yeah, you should only really, like, you should be focusing your biggest assets or your biggest flexibility or bullets in trade or whatever on things that will matter in the playoffs. I don't agree with you with how easy it is to make the playoffs.
Anybody, like everybody makes it. Especially you don't have to play the Yankees or the Red Sox 19 times a season anymore.
Yeah.
They're getting in.
86 wins got you in this year.
Yeah. That's nothing.
Okay. It's nothing. That's a six. Look, the Jays could have lost six more games and still made the playoffs.
Yeah.
Is what that tells you. You still got to get there. And I do think that there is some value in being better because over the course of 162, because then down the stretch, you can make the kind of decisions you're talking about in terms of getting guys ready for the postseason. You can make them with a little bit of a cushion in the standings. You don't have to play that best two out of three, which even if you're the best wildcard team in the world, that's a coin flip.
Yeah.
A little weighted, but like the Jays were 55-45 favorites against Seattle, and that was the biggest gap in a wildcard series, and look at how that went.
Yeah.
I think you want to avoid, I think what the lesson from this year should be is that you really want to avoid that wild card. I go the different direction than you. I think that that said to me that there's even more importance on the regular season and performing better in the regular season than less.
I mean, it would have been nice to have a bye, I suppose, and then go five games against the Cleveland Guardians, right? Like barely get out of a DS matchup against them, which the Yankees barely did, right? Against a very flawed Guardians team. Blue Jays, what an accomplishment. They won 92 games. They were the top wild card. They had two games at home in the postseason. A huge advantage.
I feel like you're arguing my point, not yours.
I'm being sarcastic is what I'm doing. No, I don't think it was a huge advantage. Well, obviously it wasn't. They lost both games to the Mariners.
So what I'm saying is you avoid the wild card.
Oh, yeah, okay. Well, it wasn't a huge advantage to the Yankees either, avoiding the wild card. They needed to go the five games against Cleveland, okay? You know what?
Did they win that series?
Yes, they won it.
Okay. Were they still playing 2 weeks later than the Blue Jays?
Cleveland stank, okay? I'm just saying.
Sure.
Okay. Would it be nice to have one of those top wild card teams? Are you going to be able, like, ultimately, is it going to be very difficult? Even with a very flawed Yankees team, I think a Yankees team that's bringing back Aaron Judge to, you know, go to the 100-win level that the Yankees are at, I think your best shot is getting into the playoffs and having what they already have, which is a pretty good 1-2 punch at the top of the rotation, having better relievers than they currently have, and having, you know, a similar offense to the one they just had.
Sure. What you're advocating for, basically, though, is be the same team as last year, roughly, which is fine, and you improve. If they win 92 games and they're favored in a wild card series, I won't be disappointed. I'll just be disappointed if the outcome's the same. However, I actually think the logical endpoint of the road you're going down here is not to not address the pitching. It's that bumping Jose Barrios to the fourth spot on paper is maybe actually the most important thing because – yes, you can have a lot of faith.
Ricky Tiedemann's going to do that.
You can have a lot of faith that Jose Barrios will have a bounce back year and things like that, but I still, I don't know, maybe you need a third guy then because you need three in a playoff series.
Sure. Listen, anyway, if that's how you want to allocate
your resources. The Astros have like 30 starting pitchers.
Yes, if that's how you want to allocate your resources and get like not a Chris Flexen, but like an actual, you know, Justin Verlander.
I'm actually like, big picture, I'm agnostic about where you use it, just as long as you use it and you're making the team better. Like if you,
but like I'm
like
saying,
a 3-win pitcher and a 3-win player is three wins, and your internal replacement level is going to be a little different. And I do think part of the issue with the starting pitching this year was that like Thomas Hatch and Trevor Richards and Julian Merriweather were the next guys up to start games or open games, and that's not good. Like, if you are scoring 7 runs a game, that doesn't matter as much.
I guess what I'm saying is, like, don't spread the money around. Like, almost maybe laser focus it on one guy that is a difference maker.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's Brandon Nimmo, and maybe that's what they're doing.
Maybe.
Yeah. Chris Flexen would have been bad.
Maybe it's maybe it's Justin Verlander, Jacob DeGrom.
Sure.
And there are more money cuts to come.
We'll see. All right. Speaking of money, let's make you some. It's time for a last call brought to you by Bet Rivers. It's a whole new game. Raptors, Heat, Kyle Lowry, his second game back in Toronto as a visiting player. Raptors favored by 3. They are -3 favorites. The total is 216.5. What? Gary Trent Jr. still out?
Jr. is still out. Fred VanVleet is back. Bam Adebayo and Tyler Herro out for Miami. So just a lot of absences overall here.
All right. Kyle Lowry over 13.5 points, paying -118, over 6.5 assists, -129. Jimmy Butler, 25.5 points, minus 106, and over 7.5 rebounds, minus 124. That was Last Call, brought to you by Bet Rivers. It's a whole new game. I think, if anything, today indicated to me that this offseason is going to be a little bit more exciting than I thought it was going to be for the Blue Jays.
Bring on the transactions.
Yeah.
That's all I want.
We didn't even get to say goodbye to Raimel Tapia. Fare thee well.
Okay. yeah, you miss him so much. So, there's no rule that after you DFA or non-tender a guy, you can't sign him back for cheaper than his ARB number.
I make that rule. Yeah. Don't bring back Raimel Tapia. It's fine.
Sure.
All right. We'll be back tomorrow. This has been the Fan Drive Time. Ben Ennis, Blake Murphy, Sportsnet 590 The Fan.